Hey, this is Karen, Coach's Corner Chats, and joining me is Eric DeRue. Eric, where are you at and what are you up to?
Right now, I'm Colorado Springs. I just flew in to watch some girls' high school basketball, but I am an assistant women's basketball coach at Texas Tech University. That's where in Lubbock, Texas, and that's where I reside most days.
So if you're not in Lubbock, does that mean you're recruiting?
Always recruiting, right? Always. When that's usually what it is. Like if I'm not flying to a game that we're playing on our own, I'm on the road recruiting.
How much of your life is recruiting? I mean, people hear about that and I see all the Twitter posts and people on a plane and all this. What is that experience like recruiting wise?
You know, from a day standpoint, a traditional year, you're probably on the road 60 days or so a year, plus or minus a few. The life's hit or miss, if you like it or not. I love this element of the job. It's one of the reasons that attracted me to college athletics. I love traveling. It's like, you know, today I was on two different jets, jumped from Lubbock to Dallas, Dallas to Colorado Springs. And I'll do the same thing going back in a couple of days. And I just love traveling. Like I'm looking outside at some beautiful mountains that I don't get to see in Lubbock. So from that vantage point, I love recruiting. The other elements of it is part of, you know, people talk about their why and whatnot. I think one of the blessings of my job is getting to help validate players' hard work at the high school level. A lot of high school athletes' dreams is to play college athletics. And one of the blessings of my job is to give the check mark validation of like what you're doing is right and good enough for the next level, and getting an opportunity to evaluate and offer scholarships, things of that nature. So that's the added bonus of the recruiting element.
How long have you been at Texas Tech?
This is my third season. I had an interesting venture to get to Tech, but my first 2 years, I had the title of Director of Player Development. And in that time, I did a little bit of basketball coaching on the inside, a little bit of actual basketball development that was hit or miss based off the NCAA rules. But the other elements of player development that I touched for those 2 years were I have a master's degree in sports psychology. And so that was an area, like I won't say perfect timing, but mental health and the sports psychology space has been heavy buzzword for the last 3 or 4 years. And so in that world, I just had a little bit more knowledge than the most college athletics coach. So in my role of director of player development, I got to see the things that my head coach wanted to do, but had limited time to be able to do them. And so I built out what we call the growth guide now, but it's a 12-month plan based on mental health and sports psychology for our student athletes. But as well for our coaching staff, like we have a whole 12-month program for our staff to make sure that we're taken care of holistically, not just being the grindstone of college athletics. And so that was one of my heavy parts of my job that I wasn't necessarily hired to do, but they found out quickly that was, I won't say an expertise, but something that I had knowledge in was the sports psychology, mental health space. From there, I also probably why I was hired was Lady Raider basketball has a huge legacy and history in the world of women's sports, but it had not been met like with the social media era. The success hadn't been there in the social media era, and they definitely needed a revamp in branding and social media access. And one thing that I have done well over my own coaching career is build a brand of my own. At the time that I was hired, I was the most followed college basketball coach in the country on TikTok, both men or women's basketball. And so when I was hired, I was basically told, you need to revamp Texas Tech Lady Raider basketball social. And that's what we did over the last 2 years. We were the most followed, or we gained more new followers than any program in the Big 12 over that 2 year period. And so we saw growth there. But that's a small summary of my job the last 2 years at Texas Tech. And then in April, one of our assistant coaches left to move on to a different program. And I want to say I had about a 3 to 4 week trial run in becoming an assistant here and before I was promoted. But that was something that I did previously. I was an assistant coach at another Division I, Abilene Christian University, the previous five seasons. So the coaching world was nothing new to me. It was at the right time for me to be promoted to that position here at Texas Tech. And fortunately, it was. And now I get to coach basketball, which is my dream job on a daily basis. And I love the element of recruiting. It's everything that I did my previous school for 5 years. I actually loved that element of the job. So I'm back in the space that I wanted to be in and thriving, at least personally for me, thriving in what I get to do every day.
You mentioned putting together that 12-month plan. How does one put one of those together? Like, that's not something, is that something you were working on already? Or was that just from once you got to Texas Tech and you realized like, this could be something that I could really, really dig my teeth into. How did this even come about?
Yeah, so I kind of been fortunate over my – so I've been at Fresno State as a GA and then Abilene Christian as an assistant and then Texas Tech in these two roles. And what I realized going back to my previous two spots and what I transitioned to my here at Tech was my first year, I take my job responsibilities, literally what my boss gives me, my head coach gives me and says, like, I do my job the best I can. But then I look around the program to see what holes I can fill. And year two, I start filling the holes and the gaps in the program. And again, like I always say that, and like, not that the holes are like gaping, missing opportunities. It's if I spent more time than somebody else on it, can it be exponentially better? And so what I did at Tech was that I did everything my head coach asked me to do. And as I sat back and was like, man, like, where are we missing the mark? Where can I add my time and my knowledge in for us to be even more so in an area? And that became the sports psychology mental health space. And I went in my end of year meeting with Coach Gerlich, our head coach. And I basically said, hey, I was like, I see what you're doing. Like, you're trying to build a culture. You're trying to like show these kids like what Lady Raider basketball used to be about. And transition them to having the pride in that element. In the world of the transfer portal, we had so many players that had no idea about Texas Tech until they stepped foot on campus. And like, because she got the job during COVID. So literally it was all Zoom type things. And so she was trying to bring speakers in. She was trying to do team building activities, and it felt like throwing darts at the dartboard. And there was just no rhyme or reason outside of the fact that she knew that that was right to some degree. And so I basically told her, I was like, hey, I see what you're doing. But you're super busy and you're like, you do so many things as a CEO of this program. Like I was like, one, I was like, I need to take that off your plate. She graciously said yes. And I said, two, like my, like just how I work and operate is I'm pretty detail oriented and like, I need a plan for everything. Like I live off a to-do list every single day. Probably have the last 9 years of my life with literally to-do lists every day. And so it just naturally came to me. I was like, I need to build this out over a 12-year plan. So there's no miss. And if I'm going to do that, it has to have specific reasons of why we're doing it. And so I phased it out over four segments, summer being phase one, preseason phase two, in season phase three, and then off season phase four. Phase four off season, very limited things happen because it's basically the gap that we give our players off between compliance and them being out of school. So phase four is very limited. But in the summer, we do a ton of stuff in regards to personality tests. We use the TAP riser test. I think it's the most advanced personality test specifically for teams and athletes. I mean, I've used the Enneagram in places past, but that's just general personalities. The riser TAP test gives you feedback for the athletes, for the coaches, for yourself based on how you receive information as an athlete, how us as coaches can coach you specifically in certain areas. And I took that information and to our sports psychology team and was like, hey, I want to break every one of our athletes down in specific meetings and talk about this athlete specifically. And it came into the point where the world of coaching has adjusted to, it used to be all about the athletes adapting to their coach. Is their coach is who they are and that, like, that's who they're going to be. And if you don't, it's their way or the highway. And I see coaching as a very different model of these athletes are very different people and they need to be spoken to differently, coached differently, taught differently, all of that. And that this, the TAP riser test gives you that information. It tells you how they learn, whether it's visual, doing it multiple reps over time, seeing it on video, talking about it, writing it. It tells you specifically how they learn. It tells you if they're a pressure performer or not. It tells you after setbacks, do they want to talk it out? Do they need space? Do they need positivity? And so we go through every one of our athletes during that summer period to determine how we can coach them the best. So that's a part of the phase for our coaching staff. Each phase has a challenge. And the summer challenge is to have a one-on-one meal with every one of your teammates. We believe that the relationship and rapport that sitting down and having a meal with one-on-one meal with somebody has to building a stronger rapport. The phase two challenge, the in season, is to have a one-on-one or a small group meal with every one of our full-time staff members. Going back to relationships and rapport, like to be able to coach our athletes hard, it only goes so far as the strength of our relationship. Like, I can only critique and coach a kid as hard as they know that I care about them. And that happens over time just naturally with the coaching thing. But what I realized as a coach was one of my players, Abilene Christian, thought I literally could not stand her as a human being because I critiqued her game so much. I just wanted her to be the best player that I could. But what I realized, because I wasn't her position coach and we didn't have a built relationship because of recruiting, because she got there before I even got hired in that position, was I just never had a relationship with her. And so she, every time I talked and critiqued her or coached her, she thought it was in the negative content. And I just couldn't believe that until I realized that, like, I never had a conversation with this kid that was non-basketball, non-critiquing her game. And so every month we hand out a sheet to our coaches that says touch points, and it has literally the list of our players' names on it, and it's little boxes. There's about 15 boxes next to their name. And our job is to check mark how many times each month we have a conversation with our student athletes that's non-basketball related. And so by the end of each month, you can go back and look and see, like Bailey Maupin, I always get 10 plus touches on her, like touch point, like any conversation, non-basketball is a touch point, however long it is. So like Bailey Maupin, I'm a position coach. We have a strong relationship already. I've known her for a long time. It's easy. I get 10 plus every time. Jasmine Lewis is a post player for us. I'm not a position coach. I don't naturally interact with her non-basketball. So I have to go out of my way, or that's going to say two. And if it's two, it's not good enough, because I can't coach her as hard or as strongly, because it won't be received, because we just don't have the stronger relationship. And so I just kind of scatterbrained that stuff. But there's a built out plan both for our athletes and our staff over an entire 12-month period to ensure that we are all getting the needs met, that at least in the sports psychology, mental health space, that we can. I'm a huge advocate for our players and our staff seeing therapists. A third at least of our players see someone on a one-on-one basis. But I always tell them, I was like, I can't say or make you do that unless I do the same thing on my end. And so like our university has this policy where you get up to 8 free therapy sessions a year. And like, I'm gonna be honest with you, I have an incredible life, an incredible family, very blessed. But I intentionally go see a therapist to make sure our players understand that it's okay. And like normal people can do it too. And like, there's days that I go to see my therapist that I have nothing to say outside of how can you give me tools that can help my team? And so like, I come back and give feedback to my staff or my players of different tools that like I got from my therapist, because that's the only way to normalize that situation. And so anyway, that's a long story short of what the opportunity I had over the last 2 years to build out what we call the growth guide. But it's essentially, we had an official visit over this past weekend with some recruits, and the growth guide has actually turned into one of our biggest selling points, because I just don't know a program, at least a women's basketball program in the country, that has something so established over 12 months for both your coaching staff and your players that touches mental health on at least a weekly standpoint throughout the entire year.
The other thing that I loved was you mentioned social media, TikTok, and why is that so important? Why was it so important for you at your previous stops to get to use TikTok? Why were you using it? Like, why is that something, even when you got there, that they said, we need you to help us rebrand Texas Tech basketball?
Yeah. So, the origin story of it all was when I got to Abilene Christian, they had transitioned from a Division II to Division I, and we were at the end of the transition, and I was making phone calls as a college coach, like in the recruiting space, thinking this was easy, this was going to be easy. And I had walked into a team that had just won a Southland championship and returned the entire roster, and we won a championship against. We had won two Division I regular season championships, and I was making calls to AAU coaches about players, and they all thought we were Division II. And I just was shocked. I was like, man, we just won back-to-back championships at the Division I conference in your region, and you think we're Division II. And what I realized, that the only way to change that narrative is through social media. And at ACU at the time, it was just a scatter. No one really knew what social media really was or how to use it. And in our program, because no one knew how to use it, like our head coach ran our Facebook, I ran our Twitter, our other assistant ran the Instagram, and other assistant ran the Snapchat. So it was four different people touching social media and going back to like filling holes. So I walked into my head coach's office year two and was like, hey, I'm going to take social media under my umbrella, because I see the need for us to grow in this space. You know, our SID touched it a little bit, but our SID at ACU touched seven other sports. And so like, it was literally just this game specific information. It had nothing to do about building the brand. And so one, that was the need initially at Abilene Christian, was to increase the brand awareness, to show people we were Division One and a successful one at that. As that went on, I started to kind of fall in love with the element of branding, showcasing what we were. I don't know if you've heard the name Gary Vaynerchuk or Gary V, but that was the time that like I started to catching fire with what Gary V was putting out. And his big thing at the time was document, don't create. And so like I got my head coach's blessing. It was like year two or year three. And was like, I told her, I was like, I'm going to video and record everything with my iPhone, and I'm going to edit it and make an all access show. And so I literally used an iPhone for an entire two seasons. And every week during those two seasons, I dropped a 2-minute all access episode on our social media pages. And that was one of the best things I've done. And like, again, my head coach at the time had no idea what I was doing. I literally had a cell phone on every practice. I recorded every one of her talks. And like, she was a motivational person. And I kept thinking, I was like, man, like she is too good. Like she prepares too many positive talks during practices to not be released. And so I started to make a little spinoff series for her on social media. And so like, I was just gathering content. So I was just documenting what we were doing. And over two full years, like it was the coolest. Like we had literally two full, by the end of the year, it'd be like an hour long show of our entire season recorded. And I thought that was just, like, it was super, super special. You know, I had plenty of time at the time. I was married, but didn't have any children. So I had excess time to work on projects for sure. But that's kind of where I built it over time. Eventually that translated into my personal brand. Again, COVID happened probably at the right time where, you know, I basically was forced to not go on the road recruiting, to basketball is a different space. And so TikTok, just be the perfect storm timing wise. And I found a niche in the college recruiting space. And just for me, going back to like, I'm very transparent. I'm obviously, you can see that I offer everything up. But two, like I had an interesting college journey myself in the recruiting space. My parents didn't play sports, but I loved basketball. I had to find my own AAU team. And that was before social media was even around. So like I was emailing these random websites trying to find AAU programs. I finally joined one that was 2 hours away, and I lived in Tyler, and I ended up playing on a team in Dallas. I found it on my own as a 17-year-old, my senior year of high school, and that one summer gave me the opportunities to play in college. But I had no help from my high school coaches. My parents had no idea of the recruiting process. And so my TikTok for the longevity of my time in that space was teaching high school athletes about the recruiting process. And that's really what snowballed into the mass following at the time. Was I was the guy that was giving recruiting advice. And for a while, my head coach didn't understand what I was doing or why I was doing it. And I told her about 3 weeks before we went on the road recruiting for the first time since COVID allowed us to be on the road recruiting again. I was like, when we go on the road recruiting, like we wear our logos. And I was like the biggest brands in women's basketball, the Kim Mulkeys, the Sherry Cole at the time, like the Genos, they don't have to wear their logos to be known. And I was like, to be honest with you, I was like, if I walked in a gym without Abilene Christian before TikTok, no one would have a clue who I was. And I was like, I told my head coach, I was like, my goal is to walk in a gym and every player know who I was. And I was like, that's the ultimate branding in sports. And the first day I walked into a gym with my head coach, we got stopped 25 times and asked if I was the guy from TikTok. And after the fifth time, I looked at her and was like, that's why I did TikTok, because like they know who I am. And we would bring kids on campus and they all know who I was. And again, like I've been kind of separated from TikTok for the last year and a half, 2 years. Like I've started to kind of slow down that process because I started putting intentionality into Texas Tech. I have my own family, just different priorities. But that space allowed me to really learn about the branding piece for myself, which allowed me to translate it to a higher level program like I did at Texas Tech. It just allowed me to have more creative thought process. And at Tech, we had, I'm going to say, unlimited resources, but we just had more people and bodies to be able to successfully operate what we wanted to do. At ACU, we started the first coaches, women's basketball coaches show to be aired on ESPN Plus. Again, like that's very common now, but me, I was very fortunate. I had a guy in that space, the media space at ACU that I become really good friends with. And we had talked, had a couple of drinks and we're like, we should do this. And we did. And like, again, it's commonplace now, but at the time, the only other coaches show that was housed on ESPN Plus was actually housed through the Longhorn Network, was University of Texas. And so you literally was behind another paywall. And so we were at the time the only one to have the ESPN Plus coaches show. And like even in Texas Tech, like we still don't have that. Like we have other shows that we have representing us now, but like that, like at ACU, we just were ahead of our times a little bit in regards to the media space because ESPN is always asking for more content. I'm trying to think of anything else that we've done that's been interesting in that space. But nonetheless, that was kind of branding became a part of my identity, which has been fun. And I got to be with part of the marketing team the last 2 years, just kind of push Lady Raider basketball forward. And so it just an interesting piece the last 2 years that I never knew I'd be able to touch.
If we go way back, you talked about finding an AAU team and having to literally start emailing and find your way. When did basketball come into your life? Were you picking a ball up and playing as a four-year-old? Like, was it a late bloomer? What was this kind of journey for you as a youth?
Yeah, so I think I love telling this story the most because it brings actually really positive endorphins in my body. So again, my parents didn't play sports at any high level. My dad will tell me that he ran track, but there's no data showing that happened. My mom didn't play any sports, but I was very fortunate when my family moved from Ohio to Texas when I was young, 4 years old. My dad instantly connected with, I'm going to take my son to sporting events, and that's going to be our thing. And he coached my soccer teams my entire life. And so like, I think that was the first element of coaching. When I started really thinking back, like I became a coach because that's what I saw him do for me, was he coached every season of rec league soccer from my age 5 until I was 13 and transitioned to different sports. So for that 8-year period, that was my coach every season, was my dad. I never saw him work. He worked at a hospital in a chief financial role. So I really never got to see his work day to day outside of he left before I woke up and he got home at 6. And as soon as he was home at 6, he was my rebounder or he was my coach. Like that was every element I saw of him with my dad was him being my coach. So I always pushed that my coaching genes come from my dad, even though he wasn't like the ultimate athlete. He was just wanted to be a great dad. And then from a basketball element, I'm not sure necessarily why. Here's the story really, is my high school, small private Christian school in Tyler, was really good in high school basketball. Again, it was classes of less than 100 per class. My high school, like 300 kids, but really high level basketball coach oversaw the boys basketball team. And when I was young, fourth grade was the year that they won state. But my dad and my family would take me to every game. And because it was a small Christian school, the district was Tyler and Dallas. And to Dallas is a 2-hour drive. So my dad would get me out of school every Tuesday and Friday to drive to Dallas to watch district games. We had no connection. We didn't have an older sibling. We didn't have a connection to players on the team. We were literally just driving to Dallas to watch these high schools play basketball because that was our connection to the sport. And so, like, again, fourth grade year, we drive to College Station to watch Art Pierce hit a game winner buzzer beater to win a state championship. I still have the ticket stub of the game of a state championship my fourth grade year. I think that like those years developed the love of basketball for me because like that was the most prominent sport at our high school. We didn't have football at the time and like the other sports were just okay, but basketball was the lifeblood of our small community. And so we had an incredible basketball coach that just thrived that program. That my biggest frustration, and he knows to this day, is he retired when I entered high school. And so it was unfortunate because I played for three different coaches over 4 years at that high school. And it literally killed me inside because he was a legend. And he came back to coach girls high school basketball at that high school after I graduated. He came out of retirement. And like, it was so frustrating to me because I never got to play for the legend that built my love for sport. Where college basketball came into play was, I can recall, like, growing up, spring break, we'd always go to Florida at my grandparents' house. Oh, and it'd be like that first weekend of March Madness. And I vividly remember, like, the newspaper cutouts of the bracket. So that'd be the only bracket I have, would be the newspaper cutout. And so that's where I would fill out my bracket, because, you know, now it's on an app, whatever, but like the hard copy, like, I had one shot to get it right for my newspaper to fill it out. And that was our spring break, was basketball. And so my parents and my family, we would travel to different destinations over spring break, and I would sit in front of the TV and just watch basketball. And so, like, just over time, that just became the love of who I was and what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I was, you know, I always attest back to fourth or fifth grade was really when basketball became like the fire in me. And then over time, it was college coaching was going to be my career, because I just saw just that as like the biggest level of passionate fans. And like what basketball really was all about was college athletics. And so I've always had the dream and the career of being a Division I college basketball coach. So I live my dream every day, and like, I'm a parent now. And like, so now it's my turn to do the same cycle. And so I'm currently on this. My goal is for my daughter to go to 50 Texas Tech athletics events this calendar season. So we're somewhere in the 30s right now of athletic events. But like, to me, like that's how I was fueled with the love of sport, was just being around it and immersed in it because of my dad. And so that's why I try to give my daughter the same experiences, in hopes that she finds something that she's passionate about in the sport, in the world of sports.
When you look back at that first experience of having your dad as a coach, and you said you feel like that's what kind of ingrained you, what was it about your dad as a coach, not necessarily as dad, that resonates with you when you look back and go, those are some of the things I really loved that he did as a coach?
I think it was he wasn't this extreme, like, knowledge of the sport itself. He just wanted to give everyone that he coached the best experience. And like, it's the coolest now, because, like, you know, I'm getting old, I'm 32 now, so we're getting older, but like in that mid 20 range, when a lot of, you know, like the people get married for the first time, like he was getting invited back to like weddings of like kids that he coached in like sixth grade. And like, I think that relationship and like that piece of like, again, he wasn't the greatest soccer coach of all time in regards to X's and O's and like how to develop, you know, whatever, like, he just did the best that he could in caring for all these kids and giving them an opportunity. I think that consistency was something that played a huge piece to it. It's actually interesting, because again, 4-year-old daughter now. So she's playing her third season of soccer, rec league soccer. They just started, and we're on the same team. And my wife's like, we should give her a different experience, like a different team or a different. And I was like, no. I said, this guy who's leading the Pink Panthers right now for my daughter's team, I was like, he's doing it. I was like, he's doing what my dad did. I was like, he's giving these kids a great experience, and he's consistent. And I was like, and that's what my dad gave to me and a bunch of my high school buddies or my youth friends, was he gave someone that was consistent and it would always show up. I mean, I'll drop this story. I've never shared this story in a setting like this. We had a player that moved into Tyler and joined our rec league soccer team. And his name was Onyekon Isong. And didn't have a dad that was actively in his life. So it was just him and his mom and his sisters. And my dad would take him home after every practice. Like that was just coming before we did. Like mom was able to get him there, but we would take him home. And eventually, like we would practice at where I went to school at. And he eventually, my Isong, which he goes by now, would started asking my dad about that school, about Jesus, about school, about Grace Community, like where we were going. And my dad was like, do you want to go there? And he was like, yeah, I do. And my dad was on the school board, and he went to the school board and was like, hey, I have somebody that I think would flourish in this environment. And so he helped Isong get a scholarship into our school, and he absolutely transcended everything about that high school. And I was like, we went to a majority white private Christian school, and Isong was one of the only, like, you probably count on my finger, like how many, you know, African-American guys were in our school. And he absolutely transcended like the personality, and like everybody fell in love with it. And like Isong like beloves my dad for that to this day, because he probably would have been somebody else in the system, the public school system, that probably would have just been passed along. And he was given an incredible opportunity by my dad pushing him forward and saying, we're going to add this student to our school, and he's going to give us more than we could all ask for. And he did. And so like my dad, like I don't think my dad's ever shared that with many people himself, because he just was doing what a dad should do. But like he took that as a coach and like changed this kid's life forever. And so anyway, those are the elements I see from my dad, that were way beyond just his work ethic as an employee. Like he affected so many lives as a coach, and that wasn't even his profession.
You talked about your first spot, like being a GA. Like, how does one, you, I'm assuming you go off to college and do that experience, but how do you get started as a coach at the college level?
Yeah. Again, I love this story too, because, you know, I think networking is a piece of college athletics, or every athletics in general, the world. But I think networking is something that I've kind of fallen in love with over time. So I played college basketball, super low level, 2 years at a Division III, 2 years at an NAIA school. But again, like playing college basketball to me was a means to getting to college coaching. Like that's just how I naturally saw it. I was like, you have to play in college to coach in college. Is that true? Not really. But it was true to me at that time. And so again, like I was a really good high school basketball player, and a really good high school basketball player gets you Division III NAIA type looks, you know, some junior colleges, things of that nature. So again, I played 2 years D3, 2 years at NAIA school. When I moved from my Division III to my NAIA in Kansas, the only player that I knew in the state of Kansas, only person I knew in the state of Kansas, was a female basketball player that played at Kansas State. And so when I moved there, I started to go to K-State games as often as I was allowed to, between my time off. Like I was redshirting, so like if I needed to miss a game to go to K-State, I probably would. And over time, I kind of fell in love with the higher level Power Five athletics. And what I didn't know at the time was if I was going to choose women's basketball or men's basketball. Early on, I thought I was gonna be the next Coach K, like who doesn't? And I remember my Division III head coach my first year, my freshman year, saying, hey, if you want to coach Division I athletics, look at women's basketball. Like it's growing exponentially, and it's a little bit easier to get in the door in, because men's college basketball, like if you didn't play Division I, if your dad didn't coach or play in the NBA, like it was just a harder road to grow your career. But he was like, there's no difference. He was like, you're getting to coach college basketball and do what you love at the highest level. Like, he's like, you should consider it. And so like, to be honest with you, I probably laughed in his face and was like, no shot, I'm coaching men's basketball. So years go down the road, I start going to K-State women's games, start going to K-State women's practices, for a Hall of Fame. She's not in the Hall of Fame yet, but she should be in Deb Patterson at Kansas State. Like she opened the door to me to be able to, I was at shoot arounds, I was at practices. I went to, like, she opened the door to me for I have no reasons why. And by the end of my senior year of college, I realized that women's college basketball was going to be my route. And I got there because I started to go to K-State men's games, and I was looking at, to be honest, 6'11" dudes from the Bronx. And I was like, man, I'm not sure I can relate to that guy. And I was watching the game flow, and like every play was above the rim. And I haven't dunked a lot. I like maybe one time I scraped the rim in a game, and it wasn't on purpose. And so when I was watching these women's games, I was like, I get this, because like I needed a screen to create a scoring advantage for myself. I needed someone to create scoring opportunities for me. I could hit shots, but it was only because my better teammates were getting me shots. And that's women's basketball at the 99 percentile of the game. Is like there's only a small percent of women's basketball players that can create their own shot consistently over time. That's a good one. And fortunately at Tech, we got two or three, and that means we're pretty good. But the rest of them need the actions. They need their teammates around them. They need the coaching, the X's and O's to create those scoring opportunities. And so that's from a basketball standpoint, I was like, that's me. Like, I get that. Like, I can coach this level of game because, like, I love the X's and O's, and I love the strategy of the game. And I've never, have been more athletic that the X's and O's didn't matter. And that's where I see sometimes Power Five basketball is you just put your best players and athletes in space to create the advantage. Where in women's game, it's literally the X's and O's matter almost every time, unless you have just incredible athletes in a one-off situation. So I choose women's basketball. And fortunate for me, Kansas, the state of Kansas loves basketball in itself. So the men's junior college national tournament is in Hutchinson, Kansas, and it has been and will be forever. That's where men's JUCO is. At the time, the women's JUCO national tournament was in Salina, Kansas, which was 10 minutes away from where I was going to school. And again, spring break is good to me. So all of my, like all my friends, whatever, go home for spring break, and JUCO Nationals is 10 minutes away. So I don't go home. I don't go to Panama City or whatever my friends went to. I went to every women's JUCO National game over spring break from start to finish, 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. every day. Went to JUCO Nationals. The only people that go to JUCO Nationals are absolute hoop heads and college coaches. And so, like, literally, if they aren't fans, like, parents and fans of those small teams, and, like, parents and fans, there'll be, like, 22 people per team were at these games. And so the other 200 people sitting in these stands were college coaches. And so what I would do is between every game, they put 30 minutes on the clock, I would go find somebody to sit next to for that 30 minutes and introduce myself, tell them who I was, tell them that I was looking to get into college basketball and asking their story. And so, like, they would tell their story of how they got in. I'd be like, all right, cool, like, are there any like words of wisdom that you would give to me in this space, how to get a GA position, whatever. And I did that every hour on the hour for 7 days. And I was passing out business cards, like doing everything I could. But I never asked for a job. I just wanted to learn from these people who are in these positions. And by the end of it, I was very fortunate. I met the head coach of the University of Northern Colorado. And the very first time I met her, I talked for 30 minutes and we stopped because the team was about to play. And I was like, I always said, like, I'm not going to interrupt your work. It's like between warmups, I didn't care. But once the game starts, like, I'm going to go sit down in my seat. But at the end of our conversation, she said, Eric, she's like, my drive from Greeley, Colorado to Salina, Kansas, my AD called me and said I could hire a GA for the first time in school history. She was like, and I was like, that day. And she was like, I think I want to hire you. And I was like, cool. And so, like, 3 days, like, we talked every day. And the semifinal day was the last day she was there. She called me and she was like, hey, let's grab lunch for the semifinal game. So we went to Chili's and we were there for 2 hours. And I didn't know it was an interview. Like, we were just shooting the bull. Like, she was getting to know me. I was learning about her family, her kids, like, the whole thing. And everything was great. And, like, 6 weeks to 8 weeks go by. I applied to grad school and I end up getting in. I drive out to Greeley. I meet the whole staff. Everything was great. And in my head, I'm going to University of Northern Colorado. Like, she would tell me, like, to look at housing options. Like, she took me to different apartments. Like, it was done. And I get home the next day and I'm Googling University of Northern Colorado housing. And in the Google news feed, the first article that pops, no lie, this is exactly what happened. The first article that pops up was women's basketball coach resigns. And I'm like, I'm just like, my soul is eating alive. And so I click on it and she accepted the head coaching job at Fresno State. And in fairness to her, she built Northern Colorado from a Division II to a Big Sky championship team. And that's a hard feat to do. And so Fresno State called her, got her the job, whatever. So I texted her, I was like, congratulations, best of luck. And she was like, Eric, she's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know I was getting it. Literally, yes, 24 hours before. I didn't know I was getting it. And she was like, but my associate coach is going to get the job in Northern Colorado and he's going to keep you. And I was like, cool. So I texted him. He was like, yep, you got it for sure. Like, it's just, you know, logistics, like, whatever. Come to find out, he doesn't get it. And they hire the associate head coach from Kansas State, who I learned to appreciate. Her name's Cammie Etheridge. And so I was like, well, maybe Cammie will hire me. And that doesn't happen. And a month later, Jamie White at Fresno State calls me and she said, Eric, she was like, some things fell through with the GA that was supposed to be here at Fresno. Basically, she let her go. And she was like, do you want to move to Fresno? And I was like, absolutely. And just the best part of that story was she was like, don't hang up when I tell you how much you're going to make. And because in Northern Colorado, like, it was room, books, board, incredible stipend. Like, everything was taken care of. Like, it was basically a full-time job. And at Fresno, it was a minimal stipend, and that's it. Like, I had to pay housing. I had to pay out-of-state tuition, whatever. And I was like, yeah, when can I get there? Like, I'm all in. I'm going. And so that started the journey of my opportunity at Fresno. And that, like, that's a whole story in itself. And it's an incredible opportunity there. She hired a whole new staff, so she didn't bring many people from Northern Colorado. But she hired her former head coach, who was her junior college Hall of Famer, as their director of basketball operations. And he didn't think he was going to be traveled because of some health stuff. And so that's why she put him in a non-recruiting role, just the double full-time position. Like, most people now at the higher level would call that, like, a special assistant to the head coach or chief of staff. But she didn't have the finances to, like, make that position. So the next highest position was the Dobo. And so when I got there, she was like, hey, Coach Perkins is the Dobo via pay and title, but you're actually going to do all that work. It's like I was doing team travel and camps and all the things that Dobos do as a first year GA. And while being a GA, while doing grad school, and it was learned by fire. And it was the best, hardest thing I've done in my entire life was to do that. And it really taught me the ropes of college athletics. And I just learned so much during those 2 years. I continue to network, and that allowed me the opportunities I've had down the road. But that's the long story of how I got in to college, women's college basketball.
One of the things that popped in my head was thinking back as you were talking about wanting to play for the legendary coach in the high school and having three different coaches. What was it? That was it difficult for those coaches to follow a legend, or why didn't someone stick, I guess, in a way? I'm kind of wondering about that as well.
You know, I mean, to my understanding, small private school pay less than public schools. And so it was a really good basketball job, but it was a really low paying job. And so like that, the previous head coach was also the AD. He was in a principal role. So he was a well-paid basketball coach, and like he just loved basketball. So like the other things paid for his life, basketball was his thing. These other coaches would come in and like basketball was their job, and so like they would have a little bit of success and then move to the public school. It's so like they didn't hire the person that was like the longevity guy. It was who was the best head coach right now, and then they were gone. And so like they were like it just lost the building of a program, because like, again, lower pay, public, like private school, public school situation where like, you know, retirement systems are different, things of that nature. So like, I think I didn't understand that at the time, but now I look back and this made a ton of sense for them to move on to, like, you know, my last coach was there. Like, I played for him for 2 years, or I guess for 1 year, and he was only there for two, and he went to a small public school after that. But like he also took an assistant principal role. So like that was a $20,000 pay grade upgrade, like all money moves.
So you have this awesome, like sounds super busy GA experience. How do you end up at Abilene? How's that end up that you end up there?
Yep. So again, networking is a play that I completely now understand is college athletics in a nutshell. And you know, when you're a GA, you don't get to go on the road recruiting, at least in the basketball position. So, you know, I knew at the end of my first year, I was looking on to year two and was like, man, at the end of year two, I'm going to need a job. And like, again, like I played low level college basketball. So I saw my college loans sitting there like looming of like, man, like this is going to hit me in the face if I don't get a full-time job. And so I was like, the only way to do that is by networking. And so I started early, like end of my first season, starting to email college coaches, asking them the same questions that I was, you know, when I was trying to get a GA position, like, how'd you get into college athletics? Like any words of wisdom, like of staying in or of getting a full-time position, things of that nature, trying to make it about them, less than me, like not less than like, I need a job. And I always say I was probably getting 20%. You know, email responses back, and I'd end up talking to 10% of them, and which is a fine number, but like it really wasn't like making me feel like I was getting anywhere. And fortunately for me, on the men's side of Fresno State, one was a head coach. His name is Rodney Terry. He's now the head coach at Texas, but his associate head coach was Jerry Wainwright. And Jerry had been the head coach at DePaul when the Big East was the real Big East. He was the head coach at UNC Wilmington, Richmond, taking all of them to NCAA tournaments. And he was on kind of his retirement swing. He had kind of helped younger coaches build their programs. He was on staff at Marquette for Buzz Williams when Buzz Williams was young. Buzz Williams is now the head coach at A&M. And he bounced around to kind of help people build their program in the early essence of it. So that's what he was doing for Rodney at Fresno, was helping him build the program. And what I learned was I knew he was an incredible basketball mind, an incredible human being. But during that spring of my first year as GA, the Wall Street Journal did an article on him and how he would get to the office at 4 a.m. and write handwritten letters to people like in his network, in his circle. And this thing grew to like he was sending letters to thousands of people a year. And it started when he was a high school basketball coach. And when he was coaching his son, he was writing letters to his son. And his son was like, that's cool that my dad's writing me letters. Well, come to find out, he was writing letters for every player on the team. And it was like once a week or almost every day that he was writing these little notes to his team. And it just kept going. So every spot, he would continue writing letters to his current players, but then he would start doing it to former players. And then he would start doing it to coaches that he got to meet along the way. And it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing to where he was sending thousands of letters every month to thousands of people and like, it became this whole like Jerry Wainwright note thing. And so he had certain, when he would like do a full note, it'd be on his like note letterhead. His other notes were, he accumulated, man, it had to have been 100,000 like small quotes of things. And he would be always spot on. If like he knew you were going through something specific, he would have a binder and he would send like 7 notes specifically about adversity or about whatever. And he'd write a small note on the front one and it would just be quotes or stories that he had accumulated over time. And like I fortunately got to interact with Jerry after I read that letter or read the Wall Street Journal article. And so I got very fortunate within the tree of people. And so I have like 3 binders full of notes from Jerry, like 3 3-inch binders, like massive binders of notes from Jerry Wainwright. But that said, like I started asking him about his notes and he was like, Eric, because I told him, I was like, I'm emailing these coaches and people aren't really getting back to me. And he was like, Eric, and he's like 65 at the time, 70. And he was like, Eric, he was like, go look at how old all these head coaches you are reaching out to. And I went back and like, they're all like 45 and above. And he was like, their era, like their love language of their era is handwritten notes. And he was like, I bet you if you start writing these older head coaches and handwritten notes, they're going to get back to you. And so I literally started taking the exact thing I would write in the emails and put them on handwritten notes and send them in the mail. And I'm telling you, it went from like 20% response rate to 65 to 70. And so like I was sending 3 handwritten letters a day over that spring and summer. And I probably got to talk to over 100 college basketball coaches over that summer. And very fortunately, I got to talk to some credible basketball minds. And his biggest point, what I always tell people was, I was never just Division I. Like I would go on the NCAA website, the NAI website, the JUCO website, and pull stats from every stat category. And if your team had a top 25 stat, I would write that in the note. And so like I was like Sherry Cole at OU, like top 10, you're number 10 in the country in rebounding at whatever rebounds per game. You were top 5 in turnovers per game, or you know, forced turnovers per game, or in top 2 in field goal percentage. And I'd be like, I would love to hear how you built your team into these specific categories. And I would do that for every level. And so like I would write in a notebook all the exact stats that I sent each coach. So if somebody called me out of the blue, I'd pull my notebook out and be like, okay, Sherry Cole, I asked her about field goal percentage and how she built her program around that. What I realized in that additive piece was, just because you were really good in a stat category didn't mean you had a great season. And so the coaches that were reaching back out to me were the coaches, like a lot of them, about half of them, like had abysmal years, 5 wins, 7 wins, whatever, but they were top 5 in a category. And I remember this once very specifically. His name was Terry Zay. He was the head coach at Canisius College in New York. And he called me out of nowhere. And he was like, Eric, a few years ago, we went to the NCAA tournament and everyone wanted to know our secrets, whatever. He was like, we just had the worst year of my coaching career at Canisius. And you're the only person that's reached out to me. And we talked about free throws for 30 minutes. And he became a really good friend. He ended up getting let go a few years later. He became the associate head coach at VCU. And we still communicate until he recently retired. And like, that's what I realized, like everyone reaches out to like the premier coaches who are winning all these games, whatever. They're not always reaching out to the people that aren't there yet, or they're building a program or whatever. And so I think that happened to be my niche over time. I was doing the same thing for Division II, Division III coaches, NAI coaches. I reached out to an NAI coach who, come to find out, he had led NAI women's basketball in 3-point percentage like 5 straight years. And he called me the day he got my note. And he was like, Eric, he was like, I've had so much success. He's going to be NAI Hall of Famer. He was like, but nobody talks to me ever about basketball. And his teams were 30 wins every year, like incredible 3-point shooting teams. And like, but nobody, because he was an NAI coach. the funny trickle to that is he had coached NAI basketball for 30 years. 3 months after I talked to him on the phone, he became the associate head coach at Illinois because somebody saw, it was like, man, like this coach, this dude can coach some ball. And they hired him on a whim at a Power Five school. He's back coaching NAI basketball now because like that head coach ended up getting let go. But again, like I think I just went around different ways in the world of networking. That's a long story into the Abilene Christian play. Was I reached out to a Division III head coach in Texas at the University of Texas Tyler. It's where I played for 2 years, but new head coach. I didn't know her, so I reached out to her, and we ended up building a professional relationship over that summer and that year, and met her at the Final Four. And at the Final Four, she was like, Eric, she's like, if you ever need anything like in this space, just give me a call. And, you know, people say that, and you really never know, like, what that means or if, like, it can actually help you. But literally 6 weeks go by, and the Abilene Christian job opens. And she was previously the associate head coach at Abilene Christian before she took that head coaching job at UT Tyler. And I called her and I said, hey, any chance you know anything about this assistant job at Abilene Christian? And she was like, actually, I do. She was like, they've had 4 interviews and the head coach doesn't like any of them. She was like, do you want it? And I was like, I would take that job if it was offered to me. And she was like, cool, send your resume today and I'll call her. And so I sent my resume. Literally that next day, I was in San Luis Obispo, California, and I got a call from the head coach, Abilene Christian, talked for 30 minutes. And she was like, when can we get you out here? And like, I was literally like about to board like a cruise ship for like 3 days with my fiance and her friends. And I was like, as soon as we get back at the dock, I'll get on a flight from LAX to Abilene. It's exactly what we did. So 4 days later, I have a job at ACU and I'm moving to Abilene, Texas. And so that was all from a Division III head coach who, come to find out, the head coach at Abilene Christian, she played for and was the D3 national player of the year for at a Division III way back in the day. And they end up becoming that, they're now best friends. And so what I've learned in the coaching space is head coaches hire who they know and trust first. And then the second tier is they hire who their inner circle knows and trusts. And so like the initial people that Julie Goodenough at ACU was trying to hire, she didn't have enough money for, or they fell through or whatever. And so like, she was on to like, who do my best friends know that I should hire? And so I very fortunately fell in that window of Kendra Hassel, or now Kendra Whitehead, put my name up. And so the second she put my name up, it was a done deal. And just fortunately, like my resume going back to like at Fresno, I was basically the Dobo. Well, at Abilene Christian, the third assistant also did all the Dobo stuff. So team travel, whatever. And so like that was holding everything up. It's all these other people that she was interviewing had never done team travel, had never been part of director of ops logistics. And so like, she was like, I can't teach them how to be a coach and teach them how to do this. And so like when I was hired, it was cool. I had done team travel and Dobo stuff at a high mid-major. So like, she wouldn't have to reteach me that stuff. She was just going to teach me how to coach and recruit. And she was like, I can do that. And so that's what, like, just very fortunate the pieces fell in play for those opportunities to go to Abilene Christian. We get there. We have a ton of success. I was part of 2 championships, the first ever NCAA tournament appearance in school history, the first ever postseason win. We beat Oklahoma State in the NIT my first year. Like, just a bunch of great things happened at Abilene Christian. Was there 5 years going on 6. Wasn't trying to leave. Like, I had the dreams of staying at Abilene Christian my entire career. Everybody knows that. That's in my field and in my space. And so I just, the right thing happened at the right time to go to Texas Tech, and here I am.
What was it about Abilene Christian that led to that success? I mean, I know it's all about having all that, but was there an it factor about that group, about that program, the coaching staff? Like, what is something that you, when you look back, it resonates with you that's something that was the difference between being good and being great?
You know, when I realized that Julie Goodenough, the head coach at ACU, was an incredible culture builder, incredible basketball man, especially offensively. We, 2 of my years there with her, we were number 1 in the country in effective field goal percentage, ahead of the Baylor and the Oregon's at the time. Like, incredible offensive mind. She was ahead of her time in the analytics play, like threes and layups, which is now all over the NBA and college basketball. She was doing that before a lot of people understood analytics. And so from a basketball element, that was one thing. But the second was just the intentional touch of culture. You know, she's a big Dabo Sweeney, John Gordon, like she loves those elements of culture and like how you build a program. And so, you know, we had our own, you know, sayings and like consistent buzzwords within our program that be kind of come ingrained in you as a person when you hear them and say them all the time. And so like control the controllables, be a part of the solution, not the problem. Like she had just a million of these sayings, but when you say them over time, they just become part of you. No job is not your job. I heard that all the time. And that's the most mid-major thing of all time. Cause at the Power Five level, like there's people, everybody has jobs and they're specific to them, but the mid-major life, no job is not your job. You just do it and you just take care. It's like, she's had this vocabulary that just built a culture, and everybody understood it and everyone was a part of it. And you either all in or you were out. And like that, and I think that's what drove the culture was like she recruited the people that were going to be all in. And that's what was the success was like she recruited the people that were good enough at basketball. But in fairness, like she took them as a Division II team, transitioned them to Division I, and in year three and year four of the transition, won the Southland outright. And so like in those first 4 years, you can't go to the NCAA tournament. And so that those teams would have gone to the NCAA tournament would the NCAA have allowed them to in the transition. But it was because, again, we had really good basketball players. But in fairness, she was ahead of the game analytically. But two, like the culture that she built was just so strong, a foundation that it like everyone was on the same page at all times. And I think that was what like taught me, like it will teach me how to become an even better head coach when I become one, was my time with Julie. Like I love her to death. Like it was unfortunate the way that like my exit ACU happened, went to Texas Tech. Like, it really put us in a bind and a friction piece for about 5 months. And now we talk almost every week. Because I left her in a tough spot at a tough time. Because I left her late. Like it was at the end of September. So school had already started. And it's like one of the decisions that she relied on a ton, literally left her on moment's notice. I found out about the job, interviewed for the job, and moved in 2 days. And like for so, and like it was never meant to be like that, because again, I never thought I was leaving Abilene Christian. And there's a whole story to why I left and how it happened, like within that phase. And it's actually worthwhile telling. So if you want, we can talk through that. Mm-hmm. But going back to the success at Abilene Christian, people talk about culture. That Julie Goodenough is the definition of how to build a team by culture. If you ever have the time, and I might be able to see if I can find a copy and send it to you, very fortunate timing. But we had a really good team my third year there. My first year, we had returned our entire roster. And we knew we were going to win a championship. My goal was to not mess it up. And we very fortunately, I stepped out of the way, and we had a ton of success, and we won the regular season championship, go to the NIT, beat Oklahoma State. The Oklahoma State piece is important because Julie had been the head coach at Oklahoma State and gotten fired at Oklahoma State. So she got to go back to Oklahoma State and beat them, and the NIT was so much – it was gold. It was incredible. But then my second year was a true rebuild. We had four all-conference starters graduate. And so the rebuild, year two, sophomores having to play a ton of minutes, but we felt it building. And so my year three, we felt like we had a team that could do it again. And very fortunately, the vice president at ACU, big fan of Julie's, incredible human being, was an author in his own right, came up to Julie and said, "Hey, I want to write a book on how you build culture in a team. And I want to do it on this, like over this year." And so he had her journal the entire season about what we were doing, culture building, team building, recruiting, all the things. And very fortunately, we made a magical run in the Southland tournament. And we went to the NCAA tournament for the first time in school history for the first, like, and it was an incredible run. We beat some teams handedly that we probably shouldn't have, but like it was turned on at the right time. And anyway, just fortunate that was the same year that they were writing a book. And so, her team motto that she's always had there is team first wins. And so the name of the book is Team First Wins, but it turned out that he took all of her journal entries and turned that into the book. And it's literally incredible timing, situation, whatever. So that's a piece of my history that I'll go down forever. But I tell anyone that wants to learn about our culture at ACU at the time is to go back and read that 100-page book, because there is so much value into how to build a team, in that piece. So anyway, that's, again, long story short of why Abilene Christian was successful at the time. It was because of that. It wasn't the buildings or the money or the NIL or whatever. It was a true culture and a true buy-in from these group of young women buying into what the head coach was putting out. And so I just, very blessed during that time. I learned so much from Julie Goodenough and completely indebted to her for that opportunity.
The one other thing I wanted to ask about, you brought up at one point, fiance, now wife, and then having a four-year-old. What's that dynamic? How important has your wife been, and even your daughter? You talk about just almost recircling, like cyclical, what your dad did with you when you were a kid and taking you to all those basketball games and just that experience that you look back on fondly. How important and where does your wife fit into Eric, the coach, in this whole journey that you've been on?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, because it's probably one of the most important pieces. And I hinted that the move from Abilene Christian to Texas Tech was kind of unbeknownst to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. And this actually is the core of that story. So I meet my wife in Fresno. So she played Division I softball at Fresno State. When I got to Fresno, she had just graduated and started an internship in the sports information department at Fresno State. So her office was in our practice facility. So I passed by her office quite a bit on a daily basis. We got to know each other, and we started dating within about 3 months of me getting there. And so I, over that next year and a half, got to know her and her family. And she grew up in Fresno in the Valley of California. And so, like, she had never left. And so that was the first, like, obstacle, was like getting her to leave Fresno and like having her understand that, like, I was going to do this. Like, college basketball was everything that I had aspired to be a part of. And so, like, I couldn't promise that Fresno State was our forever future. It was just one of the stopping points. And I was fortunate, and it got her entire family excited. Going back to like how much I was doing as a GA, in February of my second year as a GA, our deputy AD, Steve Robertello, and my head coach came in my office and said, "Eric, like, we see what you're doing for this program. We want to keep you in a full-time position in year three. Like, we know that you're dating Kim, and we want to keep her too." And she had, you know, gotten to a full-time role. And in all fairness, like, there's not a whole lot of females in the sports information director positions. It's a heavily male-driven role. And so the fact that they had a former student athlete that was a female that was really good at her job in that place, they knew if I left, she was leaving. And so it was like a two-piece, like, we want you to stay because of what you're doing, but we also can't lose her. And so, like, I had signed a contract to stay on as director of player development at Fresno for a third year. It was a stipend position, but they had found some money to, like, make it at least worth my while, and at least not, like, I didn't have a stress, like, I have to go get a job. But even to that piece, like, very funny, small wrinkle story. When I signed my contract, I told my head coach I would only leave for a dream job. And she said, "What does a dream job look like for you, like, in this next spot?" And I said, "Cal Poly," because I always want to coach on the beach, "in Abilene Christian." And I had never met the coaching staff at Abilene Christian, but I knew that it was close to home in a 4-hour radius of my parents, and they had success. And it's crazy how I literally said Abilene Christian, and 4 months later, I ended up being an assistant at Abilene Christian without a known connection at the time. Move on to that. I get Abilene Christian. We moved to Abilene. So that my wife comes and plays. I fortunately proposed to my wife before I knew we were moving. And I think that holds a lot of value, because it shows that, like, I didn't just propose because we were leaving. Like, it was like, I knew that I was in love with her. I knew that she was the one, that, like, it was the right time to propose, whether it was staying in Fresno or moving on. And very fortunately, like, we were blessed the opportunity to move on. I just remembered a keynote in this story was, I had promised her that we wouldn't leave Fresno if her grandmother was still alive. So, long story, my wife has a very interesting upbringing story to her whole side, but her grandmother really raised her more than her parents actually did. And over my 2 years with Kim, grandma was pretty sick and passed away at the end of our second season. Awful for my wife. My wife, or my time, my fiance, girlfriend at the time, absolutely devastated. But like, we had conversations that I would not leave Fresno, and she would for sure not leave Fresno, but I wouldn't either if her grandma was still alive. And I don't know if her grandma passed like with intention, like I seem to take over, but I talked one-on-one with her grandma so many times, like so many blessings, all the things. And like, I had to promise that I was going to take care of Kim to her, not her dad, not her, like whatever, like it was to her grandma. And so grandma passes away, which to me, like, gave us the blessing to move on from Fresno. That happens. We move on from Fresno, go to Abilene. My wife really struggled. Like, she hated being alone. She hated being by herself. And that's what college coaching is. Like, we're talking about being on the road recruiting 60 plus days. And it's different. Like, at the Power Five level, like, I jumped on a plane. I literally jump on a plane to every game I go recruiting to. It's not a car ride. It's literally like, even if I'm going to Dallas, I get on a plane to Dallas, get in a rental car, go to the game, back at the airport, back to Lubbock. And so, but in Abilene, I would drive to Houston 7 hours and back in the same day for one game. I would drive 3 hours to Dallas and back. I would drive to Oklahoma City 6 hours and back in the same night. No hotels. We didn't have the budget. So I was sleeping in, you know, truck stops, hotel parking lots, not hotels, in hotel parking lots to get 30 minutes to drive the rest of the way, let alone our travel mid-major life was in a charter bus, not a charter plane. And so, like, I exhausted all the time trying to just chip away. And she was by herself, you know, finding her own community. And while I was figuring out my dream job, right? You know, we finally get to the point where we have a child, and was fantastic, like, amazing opportunity. My parents are close enough, 4 hours away, Tyler to Abilene, to come when they could, but we didn't have like direct help. So my wife was working full time as a teacher and doing dropping kid off at daycare, doing all those things when I wasn't in town. And that's like, she probably had postpartum and just in general struggled with being alone. And like my job of being gone all the time was the struggle. And this kind of gets into the later parts of my time at Abilene Christian. We bought a beautiful home at the right time. So mid COVID, prices of houses were relatively cheap. Our interest rate was less than 3.0. Like, just, we bought this beautiful home with a piece of land and had this beautiful baby, and I had this beautiful wife, and I was living my dream job, just going to the NCAA tournament. And so I was set. That's why I didn't want to leave Abilene Christian, because I literally was living my dream. And one day my wife walks into like the room, whatever, and said, "Hey, we need to go see a marriage counselor." And I was like, "I don't understand this." I was like, "I'm super loyal to you. And you know that, like, I know you're loyal to me. We have this beautiful baby girl, like a beautiful home, like all the things that you could want in life. Like, we had it." And I was like, "I don't understand this." And she was like, "Eric," she's like, "you're right. You don't understand it. Like, I'm home taking care of," like, she's like, "I feel like a single mom. I'm alone all the time. Our personalities ebbs and flow off the success of your teams, like all the things, like, we just need to go see it." And like, she was like, "I'm seeing a counselor. I'm seeing a therapist." She was like, "My counselor and therapist keeps saying that we have to do this together." So I fought that for about 3 months because I was arrogant, ignorant, everything in the above of like, no, like, I'm loyal. Like, I kept thinking, like, I'm doing all the things I can do to support my family, to like, being like, that was like my coping mechanism was, every time I'd get in the car recruiting, I'd be like, "I'm taking care of my family. Because if we get this kid who's good enough, we continue to have success. Therefore, our bills continue to get paid." And we have, like, so that was, it was the worst rat race of life, was thinking that like this was taking care of my family when all my family needed was me to be home. And so we finally go to the marriage counselor. First session, normal, basic stuff, talking about who we are, whatever. Literally the second session, we start getting the nitty gritty of it. And the marriage counselor doesn't know much about sports, but he kind of gets the gist of my job. And so he sits there and is like, "Eric," and he's like, "how can you do your job of college coaching that you love, whatever, and be home for your family more?" And I looked at him and I was like, "to be honest, be on a Power Five staff as a support staff person so I wouldn't have to go recruiting." And my wife laughed out loud and was like, "no way he does that, because he loves coaching too much and he loves recruiting too much." And I looked at him and he was like, "is that true?" And I was like, "man," I was like, "Steve," I was like, "if that's what it takes to make sure my family gets taken care of, like, I'll have to do that. Like, this isn't like a what if scenario. Like, if that's what it takes to make sure my family's taken care of and supported, like, that's my job and role as a husband." I was like, I realized that I put my dreams, goals, aspirations ahead of everybody else. And, you know, this is probably one off track, is what I learned during that time is, you know, I had these dreams of being a college coach when I was a kid. We talked about it, like when fourth grade, fifth grade. What I realized over time, and I try to tell these people all the time, is when we have those dreams as a fourth grader, fifth grader, in high school, whatever, they are very selfishly driven, and not selfishly in a negative mindset, but like they are about you and you alone. Is your dream. And so like my dream was me being a college basketball coach, me recruiting, me building a program, me. That had nothing to do about me with a spouse, with kids and other people to take care of. It was not our dream. It was my dream. And my wife's dream was to be a mom. And she's a great teacher, but her dream was to be a mom. And so like her dream wasn't to be a college basketball coach or a college coach's wife or whatever. And so like I realized during that time period of like all of my dreams were so selfish. And that I had to reprioritize myself as a man and a husband to realize that like I committed to my wife, I committed to my family, my daughter, to make sure that I was supportive of like of everything that they needed. And that wasn't coaching college basketball necessarily. So after my second session, I speak out loud, Power Five support staff. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what I was qualified for. I just knew I coached basketball and was a pretty good recruiter. 2 weeks later on Twitter, a post pops up, director of player development, Texas Tech. And Texas Tech is about 2.5 hours from Abilene. And I knew everyone at Texas Tech's coaching staff, knew them all. And so I reached out to one of the assistant coaches and I said, hey, tell me about this position. And he was like, it's just a graphics job, a little bit of like in-house recruiting. He's like, you're not going to want it. And I was like, man, I said, I'm going to send you graphics that are better. I was on their stream, on their social, and I was like, I can make better graphics than this. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah. So I sent him. I was like, I need the exact same template of graphic. And I was like, mine's better than yours right now. And he was like, all right. And we didn't talk. A week later, he calls me and was like, hey, did you apply for the job? And I was like, no. That was the end of it. I was like, I didn't really know much other than that. And he was like, he was like, do you want it? And I was like, well, how much is it paying? He was like, I was just told if you wanted it, you'll make $15,000 more than whatever you're making at ACU. And like that was like the guaranteed is whatever you're making, they will just give you $15,000 on top. I was like, pretty good deal. And he was like, but you have to apply today and you'll talk to Krista tonight. And it's like 2:00. And so I literally run a workout. It's like mid-September. I run an individual workout. I call my head coach and was like, hey, I need to talk to you right now. And so I walk in her office, close the door. I never close doors because like I'm transparent. Like I don't have anything to hide, whatever. And my head coach looks at me and she was like, what's wrong? And I literally spit out. I was like, hey, this is what's happening. Krista Gerlich at Texas Tech is going to call me tonight. And I'm probably going to get offered this job at Tech. And she looked at me and she was like, no way. And it's like mid-September. She's like, no way. And I was like, yes. And she was like, well, here's the deal. She was like, in 2 days, you're supposed to be going on the road recruiting. I need to know in 2 days if you're going recruiting or not. And so that meant I needed to know within 24 hours, I'm going moving to Lubbock. And so that night, literally Krista Gerlich calls me at 10:00 at night, which I realize now is the norm for her because she doesn't sleep. And so we talk at 10 and she was like, Eric, and it was not an interview. It literally was, what will it take for you to move from Abilene to Tech? And I said, I need to see it tomorrow. Cause I'd only been in Lubbock for one time, half a day, never seen the campus. And so I drove to Lubbock the next day, met them at 10 a.m. Spent the whole day with the staff, watched practice, met the AD, went to football practice, went to lunch at the country club. And it was never an interview. It was like an official visit for me. Like they were like wowing me with all these things. And literally I had a conversation with Chris at the football practice and literally was like, here's the deal. Like, I will come to Tech for the stipulations. I'll help you build it because it was a complete rebuild, like absolutely bombshell of a program that she took over, absolute rebuild. And I was like, but here's the deal. I'm here for 2 years max. And at the end of 2 years, I have to leave to take an assistant coaching role because I can't be out of recruiting for more than 2 years. But like that 2 years in my head, like I didn't tell her this was for my family. Like she just thought I was moving up in my coaching tree. In my head was like, I needed 2 years to figure out how to better serve my family. But also being in the place where like, if this doesn't work out, I can't be removed from recruiting more than 2 years. And so she like handshake, like agreement at the time, in 2 years, you will be either an assistant coach here or somewhere else, but I get you for 2 years. And so that was the agreement. And, but to move that, it's like literally like I talked to my wife that night, accepted the job at 9:30 that evening. So literally it was like a 24-hour gap of me talking to Christopher for the first time and accepting the job. And I literally was no longer outside of ACU within less than 48 hours for a place that like I was starting year six and thought I could, in my head, like in the fairness to even Julie's thought process is like, I could eventually thought I would be the next head coach at ACU. Like it would take some time. Like Julie's still ways away from retirement, but like, I think that was like my goal at the time was if I just stayed there forever, once she retired, she would just pass the keys of the car to me because I loved it so much. Like I embraced everything about ACU and that community that I thought I would literally just take the keys over and move on. But what a lot of people didn't understand was the move to Tech was 100% for my family. And that it was the best 2 years of my coaching career in regards to that was I didn't have to go on the road recruiting. So like my staff would leave and like, just like my support staff today, like the rest of our staff's on the road recruiting, but they're with their families. And so like, I got to see my daughter. I was going to lunch with my daughters. I was doing all the things, you know, like the best part about Power Five travel is it's all charter planes. So like you leave Friday afternoon for a game, you play Saturday at 2, you're home by 8 o'clock, put my daughter in bed. Like every, you know, it's like a support staff position. Like I was gone 30 days, 35 days, where like mid-major life, I was gone 150. Like, and so like, it was an incredible 2 year period for me just to serve my family better and to be for my family better. And when the position for me to move up to an assistant coaching role presented itself, I had asked I talked to my wife about a month leading up to it. And I had been offered 3 other associate head coaching positions over the last 2 years at other mid-majors, high mid-majors, some really good programs to move on. And I just kept sitting there like, the money's not worth the time that I'm getting back. Like the small raises that these people are offering, some were really big raises for me to go take over some really solid programs at the associate head coach position. And I just kept looking, I was like, it's not like that $30,000 raise isn't worth the 100 days of me gone away from my family. And so like when the opportunity presented itself for me to jump up at Tech, I knew my head coach would be supportive of me of everything I needed for my family because she found out that's why I went to Tech. And so like my head coach loves my family and she knows that like I need my daughter to be around a lot. She knows I need my wife to be on. Like, so we went to Provo, Utah 2 weeks ago. My wife and daughter came on the trip. Like we went to Vegas. My wife and daughter came on the trip. We went to Hawaii. My wife and daughter were supposed to go to Hawaii. My wife couldn't get the days off work, so my dad came with me. Like at the mid-major life, we don't have the funds for your family to go on all these trips because it's a charter bus. And like, I'm not going to put a 4-year-old on a charter bus for 12 hours. It just doesn't make sense. And so like my head coach completely understands my needs to be a great dad here. And she never pushes me to go recruiting, but I love it. And I know that's part of my job. But like, I didn't have to go recruiting today. I just knew it was the best thing for our program today, but I could have easily stayed home and be with my family and my head coach wouldn't have said a peep. Because she knew like that's the best thing that I need and my family needs for me to be great. So I know that question was about my family and my daughter, but like it really was the integral piece of me leaving Abilene Christian to come to Tech was to make sure that I could serve them the best that I could. And they're now in a great place. And what I realized and my wife realized was those formative years of 0 to 2, 3 years old, like your kids need you, like need every element of your parent. It's like, my wife worked full time all day and then would have to pick my daughter up and would be needed until she went to bed. So my wife was exhausted every day. And as they get older, my daughter's almost 5, turned 5 in April. So year 4 and year 5, we're realizing that like our daughter doesn't need us. Like she wants us, like she wants our presence. She wants us to be around. She like wants us, but like she can handle more from like, she can brush her own teeth. She can use the restroom. She can like, do the things that like spare you 5-10 minutes a day or in those, you know, whatever. She can eat on her own. Like you can put food together in front of her and she'll eat it without you having to like watch every moment. And so like, I think my wife realizes that she was just exhausted every day. And like, so now in my role here, yes, I'm home slightly more, but I also get the freedom of my daughter being old enough where like she can take care of more elements of herself. So my wife has at least moments when I'm gone that she can like breathe and be like, okay, let's reset. And so anyway, just thank you for letting me share that element of the coaching piece, because definitely a huge element that all coaches I'm sure touch on at some point.
Last thing I want to ask about one of the things that you've kind of, your verbiage, I think it's been like finding gaps or kind of filling holes. Has that been something that you've always, that's been a part of Eric, like even as a youth, have you always been that like, oh, I think I could help you fix that? Or have you been kind of a solution finder your entire life? Or is that developed kind of been your, like your strength and your talent coaching wise?
I think more strength and talent coaching wise. I think I've just been very fortunate in my youth that like people were in place to help me succeed in a lot of elements. With that said, my brain just like triggered of like, I never had a skills trainer. Again, my dad wasn't the all knowing of basketball skills by any means. And so like, I think I always was trying to find a solution to make myself better. I was always finding a solution to rig the back door of our gym so I could get in every night. Eventually the janitor gave me a key. And like, those are the best stories of all time that some people have. Like, I hear people like not getting access to gyms. My head was like, I never had that problem. But like when you're in the gym all the time, you end up getting trusted with things that you probably shouldn't have been trusted with at 16 years old. But I think I always tried to find solutions to helping myself and my game grow, going back to like finding my own AU team, whatever, that I was always solution oriented for myself. And that's kind of how I survived in the sport initially. And then when I was at Fresno, the only way our program was going to survive was if I continued to be forward thinking. And because what I found out in my time at Fresno was, you know, we got hired, brand new staff. Everyone's brand new working for Jamie for the first time. We got there and everyone had to go recruit. And I was left basically with the keys to the car or the program to figure out how to get these kids moved in for summer. They didn't have camps, so I had to figure out how to get camp started up. My first big project as the GA / assistant Dobo was we went to Australia for 14 days, 3 months after we all got there. And oh yeah, in July, my entire staff's gone. And they had no idea. So like my first job was getting 40 plus people to Australia for 14 days, hotels, flights, 3 stops, meals. We played 3 games and 6 practices. So I was doing the laundry every night. And so like just forced in a position to adapt, learn, forward thinking, plan ahead, become super detail oriented. And then, so I think that forced me to continue to what's next instead of be complacent at any point. And so when I got to Abilene Christian, I no longer had school. I knew how to do travel. And so that gave me, like, I felt like I had all this free time in the world to learn something more. And so that's what forced me into learning Photoshop, graphic design, social media presence, that moved that forward. And so like, I think I just was very fortunate that I was put in places to be forced to learn new things. And then a lot of that's just innate genes. Like this is in me to be a constant learner. And so like, I'm always trying to learn and push myself to like be great at what I'm trying to be good at. And so I think that's just part of who I am in my DNA.
This chat has been straight fire. This has been awesome. And I'm going to shut it down. It's a great way to just kind of bring this to a close. This is Karen with Coach's Corner Chats with Eric DeRue. And I'm out. Peace.
Hey, this is Karen, Coach's Corner Chats, and I absolutely love chatting with coaches about their coaching journey. What's even better is I love that you took the time to listen to this episode and hope you enjoyed it. What I'd like to ask is take the time to join me on social media, especially on Twitter and Instagram, @CoachesLet'sChat. That's where we can connect and continue to build this community. Be a part of this awesome, awesome experience that I know you'll enjoy. Let's go. Peace.